Welcome to This Unexpected Life.
When you are struggling, even when he seems absent, he's not. He's there.
A podcast for parents navigating the challenges of raising a child with disabilities or special needs. Here, we share stories of hope, resilience, and messy faith to help you embrace your journey, work through grief, and thrive in your role. Whether you're just starting out or seeking encouragement to keep going, this is a space where your story matters. Join Carrie, your storytelling companion, as we explore the hope and healing found in Jesus Christ, one story at a time.
Hello there. Welcome back to This Unexpected Life podcast. This is episode 35. And my guest today is Celeste Shalley. She's a mother and a full-time caregiver to her adopted son with autism and intellectual disabilities. She is the author of a book called While We Wait, Clinging to Christ in the Trenches of Special Needs Parenting, and a couple other books, Since We're Friends, an autism picture book, and The Bully Blocker, Standing Up for Classmates with Autism. She and her husband, Mike, and their two sons, Cooper and Jackson, live in Northwest Arkansas. And Celeste and Mike founded Thrive Special Needs Adult Ministry as a ministry in their church. My guest today regularly blogs about caring for her son at CelesteShalley.com. We'll put those links in the show notes. I'm excited for you to listen to this episode because Celeste dives into her very long journey of dealing with constant threat of violence from her son, the unrelenting suffering, and depending upon God. She's really honest and raw about her journey, her family, their struggles, and some of the ways that God gave her hope through her journey. So I hope you will enjoy this episode with Celeste Shalley. Hello, Celeste. Welcome to This Unexpected Life podcast. It's so good to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
If you would, tell the listeners just a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and your family.
My name is Celeste Shalley. I live in Northwest Arkansas with my husband and my two sons. My oldest son, his name is Cooper. He's 26, and he's my son with special needs. And my youngest son is Jackson. He's 23, and he's attending John Brown University right now, but he still lives at home. Yeah, we're heavily involved in our church. My husband and I, 2 years ago, along with a couple of our friends from church, started a ministry called Thrive Special Needs Adult Ministry. And so we're really busy with that ministry.
Yeah, so you've had quite a journey with your having adult children. Can you share just a little bit about your journey in the beginning of becoming a mother to a child with disabilities or special needs?
Sure. Both of my sons are adopted. Obviously, Cooper's older. He was first. When we adopted him, he was a healthy baby boy, as far as we knew. And a couple years into parenthood, we discovered that he was developmentally delayed. And that kind of threw us into the world of special needs parenting. I really wanted to be a mother, and it was a long journey for me to adopt Cooper and everything. We had an infertility process and everything. And so I was really just euphoric and wrapped up in being a mother. So much so that I didn't really see his delays until the doctor said he should be evaluated. We did that, and I think that it just kind of catapulted me into this I'm going to fix it mode, mm-hmm. where I was like, okay, well, he's got developmental delays. Back then, they were hesitant to diagnose with autism right away because insurance companies wouldn't pay for therapies and stuff. So he got all of the symptoms diagnosed. I thought, well, we're going to do all of the things and we're going to fix it. I mean, that was basically my attitude for many, many years of just, we're going to work hard and we're going to do everything we possibly can to make sure he has good outcomes.
I hear that so often from parents, and I've struggled with that myself of just, okay, here's the diagnosis. Now we're going to do everything we can to help our child be as normal, quote unquote, as possible. When did you start to realize that maybe that wasn't possible?
Well, it took me a long time. Cooper, he was always a difficult child. So even though we were doing all of the therapies and working really hard with him at home, I homeschooled him and everything, he struggled to cope with just everyday things. Like if it was raining outside, or if he dropped something on the floor, or just ordinary things that kids should be able to kind of shrug off, he just could not handle the difficulties of everyday life. I felt like I was constantly trying to not only manage my own emotions related to parenting him, but also manage his emotions too. And so I really was in this kind of control mode of constantly trying to control his environment, trying to control his responses, trying to control my responses, trying to institute all these different strategies and things that I had read about, and just hyper vigilant over all of the things. And I think that I didn't realize, I didn't come to understand my problems with control and realizing that I couldn't control everything until violence entered the picture.
So I know that you have recently written a book that shares, you know, your story, your journey, called While We Wait, Clinging to Christ in the Trenches of Special Needs Parenting. And in that you share about how you had a decade-long journey of living under the constant threat of violence through your son's behavior. And I do know that there is a lot of families who have teenagers, adult children with autism who are facing this. And so what was it like, and how did you survive it?
Well, it wasn't something that kind of came on instantly. Cooper has, he always had the capacity for violence. And when he was younger, sometimes when he was frustrated, he would lash out and, you know, he'd try to hit me or throw. His main thing was throwing things or breaking things. And every now and then he would hit me. But when he was little, you could just kind of wrap him up in a bear hug and, you know, help him to kind of relax and calm down and, you know, do those kind of calming techniques. But when they become 12, 13 years old, those strategies are not successful anymore. Right. He was too strong. And when he became an adolescent, we saw this kind of gradual increase in the frequency and duration and intensity of these violent outbursts. And what would happen is he would start to obsess about something. It could literally be anything. He would get caught in a loop, like, I have to do this, but I can't, or I want to do this, but I won't. You know, you could not get him out of that loop. And he would constantly try to engage me in these obsessive loops. And I would say just about anything to get him to resolve the loop. I would lie to him. I would just make crazy promises that I could never follow through on. He wanted to be free from the loop, and he just couldn't make it work. And so when I was unable to get him out of that obsessive loop, he would lash out violently. Sometimes he would start to throw things. He would grab me. I mean, punch me in the head, choke me, you know, like just everything. And it was so traumatic that at first you're so stunned that it's happening. And basically I would say, Cooper, you don't want to do this. Please don't do this. Let's calm down. We'll talk about it. And then, you know, that would never work. And then when my husband would enter the picture, thank goodness for most of these years, he worked from home. Some he didn't, but most of those years he worked from home, and he would of course come running. And then whenever Cooper would see Mike, he knew Mike was stronger than me, and he would feel threatened by that, and he would lash out at Mike too. And then it was like both of us trying to basically wrangle this Tasmanian devil who's just fiercely trying to attack us. Mike and I would like look at each other and be like, what is happening here? What are we going to do about this? I started to just become very fearful kind of all the time. I was just on eggshells. Is he going to get in an obsessive loop? And what if I can't fix it? And what if we're not at home when it happens? And all of these things. My stress level was off the charts all the time because I just never knew when things were going to get out of control. And it just changed our entire lives. I mean, we couldn't serve in ministry like we wanted to. We couldn't spend time with friends like we used to. We couldn't go and do things like we used to. Cooper was always challenging, and we always had to, you know, just like every special ed parent, you've got your strategies for getting them out of the house and surviving things out in the community. But all of that just shut down. And we were basically hunkered down with this violent kid for such a long time. It nearly tore us apart. I mean, I'm not gonna sugarcoat that.
Yeah.
We were two like capable, educated adults, love our boy more than anything in the world, and absolutely helpless to change the situation. And it pretty much devastated every single part of our lives.
So what was your relationship with God like during that time of just survival?
I would say, you know, just in a few words, it was just chaotic and tumultuous because I've been a Christian my entire life. I've known the Lord as long as I can remember. There has never been a time when I haven't known the Lord. I grew up in a Christian family, and I feel like it kind of just threw me into chaos in terms of what my faith was like, because I believed all of these things. God is good. God loves me. God loves my son. All of the things that we grow up learning and believing and trusting in him. But it was so difficult to reconcile God's love for me when my son was punching me in the face. And yeah. I was crying out to God, why won't you stop this? And it was a real battle for me. It was so hard to reconcile. I mean, everybody knows that a Christian, there's going to be times of suffering. The Bible promises that. We know that. People lose their jobs, you know, loved ones die, all this kind of stuff. But when it's sort of like this, an acute situation where you're this boy that you love, that the Lord has placed in your life, is very violent towards you, it's really hard to reconcile that with the goodness of God. And it was a struggle for me. I feel like I was constantly taking it to the Lord and trying to find out, what are you doing here? You know, like, there are times when the Lord felt so near and so close, and other times where he felt so completely absent and not there at all. It was a real struggle for me to, I would say, organize the theology of that and to really come to terms with sometimes even this crazy, intense situation and suffering that we were going through, sometimes that is the goodness of God. And that's a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah, for sure. Especially if we've grown up in some ways believing that, you know, our faith is very transactional. If I do this and this, then my life's going to turn out this way, which can be common, I think, when, at least for me, because I have a similar testimony of just growing up in a Christian family and becoming a Christian at a young age, that sometimes we tend to start to believe that, you know, I followed you my whole life, Lord, so why can't you make my life easy, or at least easier?
Mine was very similar to that too. I think I looked at it kind of like, okay, the Lord's trying to teach me a lesson.
Right.
And once I have learned that lesson, the suffering will stop. And so I was always kind of like, all right, I'm looking for the lesson. And of course, the lesson is always trust in the Lord, right? That's the lesson.
Right.
Trust the Lord. And so I'd be like, okay, Lord, I'm trusting you. This can be done now. And I realized the truth of the matter is, you know, maybe I was trusting the Lord to a certain degree, but there's always deeper levels of trust that we can have in the Lord. And I think that, you know, the Lord has his purposes in things. You know, when you're in the thick of it, you just can't see it. To me, we were just hunkered down in our house. It was just the four of us trying to scrape by some sort of existence with all of the violence. And I could not see, I could not envision how this would bring the Lord any glory whatsoever. How is this going to, what testimony is this? You know, how could this possibly be the life you want me to live? It was really difficult.
Yeah, I can see how just in that threat of violence, because your body does react. You said you were fearful of just setting him off. And could you help in those moments when he would become violent and get in those loops of conversation and obsessing about certain things? And I think sometimes it is just so difficult when we are in nonstop suffering for years and years to even have belief. Is there something along the way that would just keep helping you redirect? I know one of the things you mentioned in your book, I think that really impacted me, was just not being able to share with others because of the judgment, and sometimes even just the hiding that, you know, had to happen, or you felt like you had to protect family members from what was really going on. I mean, how did you feel the Lord's presence in those moments?
I think really the thing that was just the lifeline for me was prayer. Learning how to pray and tell the Lord all of the ugliness, everything that was in my heart, ask the hard questions, express to him my anger and my disbelief and my doubts and my weariness. And I got to the point where I was really looking at the Lord as my constant companion. I almost kind of like had to visualize him standing next to me.
Definitely.
And whenever Cooper would start to get in those loops, I was engaging with him, but in my mind, I was saying, Lord, please help me say the right thing right now. Help him stay calm. Please help Jackson right now. You know, and I just got to the point where I was just surviving on prayer. It was just a lifeline for me. So not only in just engaging with Cooper, but in dealing with my marriage, which was under a tremendous amount of stress. And I would lay in bed at night and I would just pour myself out in prayer. I'd wake up in the morning and sometimes I'd just say, God, I can't do this today. I can't do this today. If I'm going to get out of this bed, you're going to have to make it happen. You know, it was like that. It was like just literally surviving on prayer moment by moment.
Yeah. And what I hear you saying too, is just this complete and utter dependence on the Lord, you know,
totally
every single moment of just, you know, all these things that looped through those 10 years. So if your story had a theme, what do you think it would be? One of the themes?
I think probably the main thing would be, if I had to kind of put it into a little motto, if you would, I would say less of me, more of Christ. That's the moral of the story. It has just been my personality to want to fix things. I'm a fixer. I'm wake up in the morning and I've got a plan. You know, that's just who I am. And so God has just so many times brought me to the absolute end of myself so that all I could do was say, I've got to depend on the Lord and I cannot fix this. I want people to hear There's nothing wrong with strategies and reading and researching and trying to do everything we can for our kids. There's nothing wrong with that. But if that's where we're placing our hope, that is hope misplaced.
Yeah.
Because I did all of those things. And I feel like with the Lord bringing me to the end of myself so many times, it's what had to happen in order for me to finally say, I've got to lay this in the Lord's lap, like completely. Recently, I came across a story online of a mother who has a son with autism. He was 6 years old. You may have heard about it. She ended up killing her son. He had self-injurious behaviors, and when she was trying to help him stop those behaviors, he was lashing out at her, and she snapped. And people look at that, you know, and I read the comments on that, you know, and there's so much judgment for the mother. And sorry, I'm going to cry about this, but
that's okay.
Man, I read that and I thought, I know how she feels. I know how she feels. I know what that moment is like where you're ready to just be done with it all. Like you just can't take it anymore. It doesn't matter if your child is 6, 16, 26. It doesn't matter. I've just been there so many times. And one of the reasons I wrote my book and one of the reasons I want to talk to people as much as I can is to say, I want to give people that, even if it's just that tiniest bit of hope, that's the thing that keeps you from caving into your basest instincts of survival. That little tiny bit of hope is the thing that keeps you hanging on. I want to give people that hope. I want, and obviously, if you can't tell by now, that hope is Christ. And I think the message that I really want people to hear is that even in the worst of situations, and I've been there, I have been in the worst of it, in the worst of situations, God is able to cause you to bear up under the weight of those circumstances. I know this is a difficult concept to grasp, but God gave me these circumstances. The suffering that we have endured in our family passed through his hands first. That's what Elizabeth Elliot says. Mm-hmm. Suffering has to pass through his hands first. And to understand that if he has given us this suffering for whatever his purposes are, we may not know them in the moment. We may know them later. We may not. He is able to cause you to bear up under those circumstances because he gave those circumstances to you, you know?
Yeah.
And so I really wished I could have had a few minutes with that mother to say, hang on, let me introduce you to hope. That's just such an important message for me to give out because, you know, our suffering wasn't like, oh, we had a little bit of we had a bout of violence and we got through it. It was prolonged and extensive. And even today, still possible. Every now and then, we have these things that pop up that are really difficult. It's not an everyday threat now. We've landed on some ways of coping. I just really want that message of hope to come out. I see it every day online, people saying, I can't do this anymore. I understand that feeling so much.
Yeah. And I think just your story and your testimony of just enduring so many years of what you've been through and clinging to Christ, like that's because that's all you could do. It is a message of hope that no matter what we go through, God is there in it with us. And I love how you said you would imagine him with you because I think we need to do that. I think we need to imagine him with us because there's a lot of times where it doesn't feel like he's really there, but he is. You know, he's present with us. He's inside of us if you know Christ as your Savior. And I think that's something that you just communicate well, that's been hopeful. Where are things right now with your son? And I know it's never over, but just where are some of the things that you've been able to see growth in you, in your marriage? And you said you started a special needs ministry, so I'd like you to talk about that in a second too.
Well, today, Cooper's 26, and at the end of my book, I talk about this crisis that we had in 2021, where we were able to kind of figure out a couple of things. And we've had an update since then as well. But one of the main things is that a lot of Cooper's violence stems from, he can have an acute violent episode related to food allergies. And so he's got alpha gal, and that is where you get bitten by a tick and it makes you allergic to all mammalian products. And so whenever he consumes something he's not supposed to have, that will cause a violent reaction. I don't understand it, but that's what happens. So there's that piece of it. But he also has, and this is something that he's, this is a recent diagnosis, that he's got a mood disorder. It's called cyclothymia. It's essentially a milder, more rapid cycling form of bipolar. And so for years, we were told he didn't have bipolar, that he didn't have rapid cycling to bipolar. And recently come to discover that this cyclothymia diagnosis is just exactly that, this merry-go-round that we've been on with him for years, that's what it is. So having that information has been beneficial because we've tried some mood stabilizing medicines, which have helped mildly. Let me just say this right now. There is no one thing that has helped, okay?
Right.
It's like a combination of a bunch of different things. We have discovered that when he's obsessive and kind of getting agitated and headed towards a meltdown, that allergy medicine helps calm that down. Hmm. Nobody really fully understands it. I'm not trying to diagnose anyone else's kids. All I know is that when he gets agitated, if I give him some fast-acting Benadryl, that is very, very beneficial to keeping things from escalating to violence. So that has been a real answer to prayer, to know that we can manage things when things start to get, you know, agitated and almost violent. And so recently, in the last couple months, Cooper has started attending a private Christian special needs day program in our area. It's something I never thought we would be able to do with him. I was always so fearful of him becoming violent away from home and without me. I'm still fearful of that. That would be my worst nightmare. It's just been such an answer to prayer. He's so proud of himself and happy to be away from mom and dad and doing successful things in the community. And it's a lot of work. I'm not going to say that it just happens easily. He's home today. He's not feeling well today. He has something that gives him some purpose, and I'm excited about that for him. And it's just a real answer to prayer. And before Cooper started going to this day program, he was so isolated and alone at home. Even though we try to provide lots of activities and things for him at home, it's not enough. He needs more. And so my husband and I and a couple from our church, we started a ministry called Thrive, Special Needs Adult Ministry. It's for ages 18 and up. You know, a lot of the stuff that happens in the church is for the little ones. And yeah, once they become adults or they graduate from high school, everything just disappears.
Yeah.
This coming February will be our 2-year anniversary. And we've got close to 25 special needs adults that are a part of the ministry, and it's a ministry to the adults and also to their families. And I can see now, you know, how our testimony is ministering to other families. And I think being open about the violence and sharing those things, because it's a difficult thing to share. It's an uncomfortable topic.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to talk about the mom who lost it with her 6-year-old son. Nobody wants to talk about the depths that special need parenting takes you. It's uncomfortable to talk about it. It's uncomfortable to talk about the violence and the destruction around your house and the ripple effects that that has on every single part of life. But I have found that being open and sharing about what has happened in our family has really created, I guess, a safe place for, even though other people don't have that same violent situation, special needs parenting is hard.
Yeah.
And I think it's created a safe place for people to be able to say, this is what's going on in my family. And that's not going to shock me. I'm not going to be judgmental about that because of the absolute chaos that was going on in our house. I just feel like I'm unshockable when it comes to special needs parenting. And so I feel like it's created a safe place for people to be able to share what's going on and ask for prayer and just even really just have someone that says, I get it. I understand. You know, I'm there with you. And just being able to point people to Christ. Really, that's just my main mantra. I just really want to point people to Christ and say, when you are struggling, even when he seems absent, he's not.
Yeah.
He's there.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. So I have two questions left for you because I can hear the wheels of my listeners. I feel like this question is just begging to be asked because this is a question I feel like gets asked a lot. But what about the sibling?
Okay.
Like, and I know he's an adult and we have to be careful about protecting their story and all of that, but I'm sure someone is just wanting to know, you know, do they hate their brother? What, how did you handle all of that in the home? And are you able and willing to share just a little
sure.
bit about
and
that?
Jackson would not be shy about having me talk about this as well. First of all, when we adopted Jackson, Jackson is like the exact opposite of Cooper. He has always been even-tempered, low maintenance. He's just the sweetest boy. And from the day that God placed him in our family, I have realized that he was the perfect sibling to Cooper. When they were growing up, Jackson was the one who kind of interpreted the world for Cooper. He was younger than Cooper, and then there was a shift where all of a sudden we realized, okay, well, Jackson's the younger brother, but he's actually acting like the older brother now. And so I always had the house where all the neighborhood boys came over. I wanted to be that house. I wanted my boys to, they were homeschooled, but as soon as the school bus pulled up, neighborhood boys would come in. And so Jackson was always kind of facilitating Cooper's participation in the friend group and interpreting the world for him. He was always the one who, when he could see Cooper was getting frustrated, he would start, you know, they had this thing that they did for such a long time where Jackson would like pretend like he was these different dog characters or whatever. And he would like do these little voices and it was always entertaining for Cooper. And so they did that for a long time. I remember thinking, man, I'm going to be sad when that ends. It eventually did. But when the violence started, you know, Jackson, there was nothing he could really do. It was actually what I wanted him to do was to go and be safe. I wanted him to go take the dogs, go in his room and just be safe. And he would do that. And then when it was all over and I was picking up the shattered pieces, literally and figuratively, and basically crying. I mean, he's seen me cry so much. He would go entertain Cooper. I think he just knew that that was a good thing for him to do, just to go spend time with his brother while, you know, Mike and I regrouped and, you know, picked ourselves up. Cooper has never been violent towards Jackson. I don't understand it. I mean, because it seems like he's so out of control when he's violent, but he's never been violent towards Jackson. And so as Jackson got older, I told some stories in the book where I had Jackson drive him around so he would, you know, stay calm. So Jackson has been just an amazing brother to Cooper. One of the things that we did when Jackson was, he was probably 9 or 10, we were having conversations about fairness. And that's a common thing with siblings in the special needs family. And so, you know, we talked about fairness and I was saying, you know, we explained to him, you don't really want things to be fair. You're going to get to go and do and be things that Cooper will never be able to do. And so you're just going to have to trust me that things seem off balance right now, but in the end, things will be better for you. And then the other thing we talked about with him a lot, even at as a young age, you know, I'd say to him, we're a team. It's our job to parent him, but as a family, it is our job to care for Cooper. You're a part of that team. And there were times when I would just say to him, Jackson, I can see that Cooper is starting to get agitated. It would really be helpful to me if you could go play a game with him right now. And, you know, and he would do it. And, you know, some people might think, oh, well, that's not fair to Jackson. But I guess I've just always looked at it like we're a team as a family. Even Jackson, he's a part of that team to care for Cooper. And going in, you know, we're going to get older. And at some point, Jackson may be responsible for Cooper. I think it was just important at a young age to bring him into that. And sometimes even just confiding, I know this is going to sound strange, but just confiding in him. Sometimes I would just sit down on his bed and I'd say, how are you doing? You know, this has been a really tough day. He always would say, I'm fine. And I'd say, you don't have to be fine. You know, it's okay to not be fine. I'm not fine right now. I guess just maybe having a little bit more of an adult conversation with a kid. I guess that's how I would look at it. Just really kind of bringing him into the process and not leaving him out of it, I think was really beneficial in our particular case.
Yeah. I think in those instances, you're affirming him, the part of the family, not just being, you know, shoved off to the side, but you're part of the team. And then you're affirming that it's okay if he's not okay. And, you know, even if he was, but it's still okay if he's not. And I think that's so important. And just having those open conversations about fairness too, I think are really important in our families. I have 4 children and one of them has the disabilities. And so we've often just had a lot of open conversations. And I think when you have those maybe higher level conversations, I think there's a level of communicating to our kids that we trust them, you know, that there's trust. Right. And I'm trusting you with this information. I'm trusting you with how this situation is. And I think that that helps them to feel needed, important, and loved even. And so I think that's really important. So just to finish up here, your story is pretty incredible. And if you get a chance, I'm going to put the links in the show notes for you to read her book. I will tell you that it is a hard story to read. I think, Celeste, that you would agree that it, you know, if you're in the thick of dealing with a child that you have of violence, you might want to wait to read it because it's a lot of heavy stories, but also just, on the other hand, you might want to read it because you're going to realize that you are not alone and you're going to be able to identify with all of the striving and the fixing and just the unrelenting suffering, but also how God was just so present in all of that. And so 2 last questions. 1, how would you encourage a mom who is in this situation right now, like you were? What would you tell her?
I guess I would say a little bit more of what I was saying before, and that is that really the answer is relying on Christ. I think it's okay to kind of like to battle it out with the Lord and yeah. to bring him all the ugliness that's in your heart and the doubts and the fears. And I spent a lot of time begging the Lord for help and everything. And I think I would say that God can be trusted to be faithful. It's hard to remember that when you're in the thick of it, but he can be trusted to be faithful. That's really what I want people to understand. And then also what I had said earlier about when the suffering feels unbearable, it's the Lord who's able to cause you to bear up under that. And I do want to say that one of the things that was extremely beneficial to me was to read books from people who have suffered. You know, I read pretty much everything Elizabeth Elliot ever wrote and Johnny Erickson Tada, and those little nuggets of things that I would pull out from their books. I mean, I clung to those things. Like I would read them over and over again, and I felt like I could trust them, even though I don't know them, but I felt like I could trust them because they had suffered. And so I was relying on people who have gone before me and suffered and also went through the same kind of battles with the Lord over the suffering. And so I learned from them, and I would encourage anyone to do that.
Yeah, that's really good. I know I was just listening today to a devotion where they were talking about Corrie ten Boom and her sister Betsy and the concentration camp. And she said, we need to be thankful for the fleas and the lice. And Corrie said, there's no way I can't be thankful for that. And then they found out later that the reason why the guards never went in there to do unthinkable to the women and they stayed away was because of the lice and the fleas. And it also allowed them to have a Bible study and share the gospel. And I agree with you. Just we have to remember these beautiful believers who've gone before us and who have suffered, again, what we would think is the unthinkable and the unbearable, and how they talked it out with God and what they learned and how they came through. So lastly, I try to leave every podcast interview with this question, but just what joy have you found in the unexpected places of your journey?
I think I would say two things. One is my husband and I have been married for 33 years, and we've been through the worst that life has to bring together. And it was ugly and brutal. And, you know, we went to marriage counseling and everything, but now our relationship is kind of like a survivor story in a lot of ways. I feel like everything was meant to tear us apart. You hear of a lot of special needs families that are, you know, have been broken up. I know how that happens. So ours is a survivor story, and there is a sweetness to our relationship having gone through all of that together and survived it. And it, you know, he had his own journey, I had mine, but we've also got this kind of journey that we were on together. And so that's brought a lot of joy. And then I think also now I'm able to really just feel joyful about it. There is a sweetness to knowing that God had a purpose in all of that. And if it's just for me to be able to sit down with somebody, even one person, and say, just hang on, the Lord is faithful. And to have that person hang on and, you know, learn how to trust the Lord, that will have made it worth it. That's why I put my story out there. I'm really passionate about wanting to give people that little sliver of hope. It's more than a sliver technically, but sometimes yeah. It feels only like a sliver.
It's true.
But the thing is I guess the point is that you only need a little bit of hope to make it to the next day. You know, you don't have to have the whole bunch of it, just a teeny tiny bit to keep you hanging on. Seeing how God has used our story to bring people some hope has really brought us, you know, some joy and some peace related to everything that we've been through. So,
yeah, that's a good word. Well, thank you so much for being willing to be so open and honest, sharing your story. And it's beautiful. And I know it's hard, but I think it's going to encourage so many who are in similar situations. So thank you.
Thank you.
If you have enjoyed this podcast, would you do Carrie a favor and hit the subscribe button to where you listen to podcasts? Also, leave a review. This helps the podcast to become more visible to others. If you would like to share your story on the podcast, visit Carrie's website, carriemholt.com/podcast, and fill out the form. You can find Carrie online on Facebook and Instagram, and on her Substack page, @CMHolt. Thank you for joining us today on this Unexpected Life podcast. Real stories, real hope in this unexpected journey.